We were looking at controlling its individual qubit and what the motion was. And if we looked at the qubit dynamics, then we saw that we could characterize the frequency of the quantizing Hamiltonian. So if we said that the system Hamiltonian was omega naught sigma z divided by 2, we could use a Ramsey experiment to characterize that. If we have a control field which is resonant with the system Hamiltonian, and so that we can use that to take a ground state and rotate it into a coherent superposition, we can characterize that coherence. We can see via the Ravi experiment that we create the coherence. We can measure T1. And the last piece is an important piece, is to say what happens with decoherence. Of course, decoherence is what makes, it's one of the things that makes quantum computing hard to do. And if we look at the rate that we lose coherence, right? T2 is the rate of coherence loss. Then there's a piece of it that comes from the T1 process, right? The T1 process says that the state relaxes back towards an eigenstate. And of course, the eigenstate would have no coherence in the eigenbasis. And because you learn something, this kills coherence. But there's also a piece that we just lump together from everything else that would lose coherence. And this piece, I'll remind you, it's equal to T1 or twice T1, depending upon the noise model. The noise model is that X and Y noise, or if it's just X noise. And it depends upon the geometry of your physical system, which is relevant. Okay. Now, it's useful to go back to our two examples. So we had one example that was a two-level system where we had a drive term in between those two levels. So I have two levels, and I have a term that allows me to... to move between them. And this time argument here is meant to indicate that this is under our control. So we can turn it on or off as we like. And then we also can look at this as a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. If we're looking at the two-level system, of course, a spin looks like that, a trapped ion looks like that, a superconducting qubit, all of those things, and many, many more, we can lump under here. Mach-Zehnder interferometers, of course, we can arrive at those in terms of optics. We're discussing them in terms of neutrons. There's a bunch of beautiful results in terms of other massive particles. Particles as large as virus particles have been used to have matter wave interferometers, and hopefully will allow us to say something interesting about complexity in quantum systems and connections to gravity. But right now, we want to look at these two as being similar. I'm more interested in why they're the same than I am in why they're different. And so here, we have our two levels. Some energy separation, some ability to drive those. Of course, both of these we can describe via the Bloch equations. I won't write them down again. We've done that a couple times. And Norbert Ramsey has a beautiful paper showing the equivalence of those. But in fact, it is really quite clear that if we wanted to characterize the coherence, then if we start off in an eigenstate, we should first rotate. So this is the preparation. And now we have a coherence. And of course, it will evolve. Meaning that it'll pick up a phase. And the lifetime of the coherence is the time that it is is a measure of the probability of finding the state on the surface of the Bloch sphere. If I only have this motion of T2, then of course what would happen is it would spiral into the origin. And of course we can directly measure that. If I'm sitting over here where I have a beam splitter, my neutron interferometer, a set of mirrors, and a means of recombining the two beams, and then my detectors here, then I would introduce a phase. I don't want to do it that way. I'll introduce a phase here. That simply says to delay or speed up the neutrons. And so we introduce a phase in that path. And of course, this is perfectly equivalent to that, that we have the preparation of a state from this blade. The evolution is given by this particular phase here. And then this blade would rotate us back, because in the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, of course, we're measuring in the eigenbasis of the paths, etc. In the two-level system, it depends upon which physical system you're looking at. You can either be measuring along X, in which case the experiment described here is complete, or for other experiments, we'll see that with the Diamond NV system, we measure, again, the projectors as we did in the Mach-Zehnder case. And then you need to have another rotation, because of course, if I simply look at the projector along Z in this case, I would see nothing. Yeah? Or what I would see is half time one state and half time the other state. All right, good. Now then, the question comes, who wanted this thing and where did it come from? Right? That's the mess, right? You know, you say, look, it doesn't do anything useful. Let's just get rid of it. and be done with this. And, you know, when you read this white paper from the UK, you know, they make a point of saying, oh, well, this term is sensitive to the environment, therefore we can use it for sensors. You know, in truth, this term is sensitive to everything. And so, yes, you know, you can have a rosy picture. We're going to use it for sensors, which we will use it for sensors. But I'd still prefer to get rid of that term and then build in my sensitivity to what I want to see by hand afterwards. All right. Now, noise. In this system, the easiest way to think about noise is to say that this phase is not well defined, right? That's what we mean by noise. Noise says that this phase is not well defined. Maybe I shouldn't say well defined. Let me say is given by a distribution. And so when I think about the state here, what I want to think about is that I have some probability of that phase. And over the phase. And the shape of that distribution is going to depend upon what the underlying physics is. You know, it's easy to say, oh, I'm just going to randomly sample from some process, and from the central limit theorem, I'll end up with a Gaussian. And sometimes that's true. Okay. But you know, there's a lot of different ways that physics shows up here. And so it need not be a Gaussian. And of course, here, I've written it right now as a distribution of actions, right? So I haven't described it in terms of a Hamiltonian. I've just said there's a distribution of actions. I want to come over here. In this case, of course, it's still this phase which is going to cause the noise. The noise is in here. Shows up in the phase. And in the neutron interferometry case, you know, we get our neutrons from a nuclear reactor. We're very, very careful about choosing the right momentum because remember that the way the neutron interferometer worked is via Bragg scattering on the first blade. And so, you know, you're only going to have Bragg scattering for a single crystal if you have the right momentum of your neutrons. But as you're, because we want to have a reasonable number, we end up having a beam here. That's about 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. So the neutron for any individual measurement, remember that there's only one neutron in the interferometer at a time, and remember that our quantum efficiency of the detectors is such that we can see each individual neutron. Okay? But each individual neutron isn't going to experience the neutron interferometer in exactly the same way because they're going to come in at a different spatial location over this beam. And so the neutron that comes in here sees a slightly different interferometer than the one that comes in there. And I said that there were perfect single crystals. They are. And we're careful in alignment and all of that sort of stuff. But the there'll always be a little bit of imperfections on the surfaces of blades, right? We machine those things. And the 20 microns of thickness is a pi phase shift. Do I have that number right?
It depends on the material that does cross for silicon.
Yeah. So for silicon, it's yeah. Okay. So what happens is your neutron comes through and it sees this roughness. And I want to show this over here. So I've got my perfect blade. This is the way I want to think about it. And now on top of the perfect blade, I've got this roughness. And so the perfect blade is giving us the unitary we want. But this roughness says that there are places where the neutron has to pass through some thick piece of silicon. And it's going to pick up a phase. It's going to go more slowly. And there are places where it's only going to go through air. And so the susceptibility, effectively, is different. The velocity is different. Now, thanks for the question. How big is a neutron? Yeah. So it depends on the momentum distribution, right? So we have a wave packet. We're very careful with momentum in this case. And so the transverse, the pieces of the momentum that depend upon Bragg scattering, then the wave packet is really quite large. So, you know, we have a macroscope. You'd say, oh, a neutron, femtometers. But no, our neutrons have a wave packet, which is hundreds of nanometers to microns, depending upon which orientation we're looking at. And that'll become important in a few minutes. And of course, by a wave packet, what do we mean? By wave packet, we mean that we're going to capture the statistics of the momentum distribution over our measurements. And I'll come back to that too. So it's important to as you're thinking, as you define a wave packet, you have to think about the whole system and the way you're averaging the system. Okay, you know, so the surface roughness is really quite small. We're good at that. You know, it's less than a micron. And the feature sizes are large because they're the feature sizes that is given by our tooling. So think about the height as being small, but the spacing down is big. And so now we've got these three blades. And the neutron's coming through and going out. And each blade has some unitary e to the I phi noise. And let's just call that the y direction of y and sigma z divided by 2. And let's call that 1. And then this one, we get the same thing, but we have the second contribution and the third contribution and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth. And of course, they're all random variables. We're all drawing from a random distribution. There's no reason that there's any correlation between the defects on one side and the other. Okay. A nice problem is to say, show me for a neutron interferometer that I can correctly and analytically treat this as one noise source, and that the noise on this side of the first blade and this side of the second blade doesn't contribute to the experiment. Okay? You see why immediately? I leave it for a homework assignment, okay? So we have the noise, and the noise comes from, in this case, these imperfections. Now, it comes from a lot of other things, too, that if the humidity is varying, if the temperature is varying, if there's motion, there's lots of things that would lead to that. Over here, we can think that there's a different set of frequencies in this. That the reason we're getting a phase here is that the energy difference is changing just a little bit. Okay? Now I want to look at this piece first. And I want to look at it in the simple case where I remind you that a neutron is a spin 1/2 particle. So I take my interferometer and we redraw it for the 20th time. But now then, as I think about this neutron, the neutron's coming from a reactor. It's coming from a cold source after the reactor. It's coming from lots of filtering. But it is half the time in the state spin up, and it's half the time in the state spin down. And of course, this is a classical probability distribution. There's no coherence of the neutron. The neutron has been prepared. It's been averaged over many things. And half the time it's up and half the time it's down. And all of these pieces in the detectors, in a simple experiment, don't care about spin. They'll do exactly the same thing for either spin state. Okay? So all of these, if I was writing this blade down, then I would say, oh, well, this blade is unitary, is equal to the unitary on the path tensor identity on the spin. Now then, I put right here a magnetic field. And here, I have two eigenstates. And let's say that these are the eigenstates of spin along z. And so I'm going to put the field along the z direction. So what does this spin, what does the field do to the wave function? What does it do to the potential that the neutron is traveling in. There's an energy that's given by the gyromagnetic ratio of the neutron times the field along the x-axis, the axis that we've applied, times the magnetic, we'll just take the z, we're all along z, times the magnetic quantum number. Right? And so this is going to be plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. This term is called the gyromagnetic ratio. And it's approximately 2 pi times 2,000 hertz per Gauss. So the neutron is going to be the energy, the potential it sees is going to depend upon its spin state. And so if I forced you to put in that potential and to calculate the velocity of the neutron over that window where there's a magnetic field for spin state up or spin state down, what would you see? I can force you to do that. If I take the 1D Schrodinger equation and I look at a solution of a free particle and I change the potential function, what happens? You guys have seen this. You change the momentum, right? That the momentum of your free particle depends upon the energy minus the potential. And here we're making that potential spin dependent. So at this point, we pick up a phase that depends upon the spin state. And of course, here I'm still going to introduce the phase phi that's under my control that I'm going to use to map out the result. So now if I look at phi, and we'll look at this detector, I don't know, it's jargon, O and H. But just treat them as labels. Then what we should see if we had no spin let's call it no magnetic field. We would have a contrast curve. Now, if I only had neutrons that were spin up, I could do that. Instead of having this equal mixture, I could select just the spin up neutrons here. And if I only had spin up neutrons, then they would go a little bit faster. And there would be a shift of this. Okay, so that's my spin up neutrons. And if I only had spin down neutrons, They would look like that. And if I have my experiment where the incoming beam is half the time spin up and half the time spin down, what do I see at the detector? Absolutely. So I see the average, right? And so what I would see is the average of those two Okay. Don't make me draw it very well. But I would see that our coherence curve would show that we're not on the surface of the Bloch sphere, right? That we're interior to the Bloch sphere at all times, right? So here I would see a loss of contrast, or equivalently, a loss of coherence, or a shifting of the Bloch vector into the sphere. And as I increased the strength of this magnetic field, then I would see the contrast becomes worse and worse and worse. But there's only two elements of the distribution. If I increased it enough, the contrast would come back. Right? Because eventually, when I'm increasing the magnetic field, I'm effectively moving these two curves away from each other. And of course, they're periodic. And so then, at some point, if the magnetic field's strong enough, then the next lobes overlap constructively, and our contrast comes back. All right? Now, of course, the reason it does that is this is a simple example where I have a distribution with only two elements. Yeah? Now I need to get back. Yeah?
When you're talking about the shifting of the Bloch vector, the sphere,
yeah.
You mean...
It reduces in length.
But the Bloch vector, is this in the path encoding?
So that's a good question. Yes, that's what I'm plotting here. Just the path.
But the qubits.
So I haven't. So in this case, what I'm saying is that the qubit I'm interested in is the path degree of freedom. And this magnetic field is a noise that's interacting with that qubit. So my interest in this case, as I draw the Bloch sphere, is just over the path degree of freedom. Now you could say, well, why don't we access the spin degree of freedom too, and we'll have two qubits, right? But you notice I haven't controlled the spin degree of freedom here. I could absolutely put a spin filter here and allow only the spin upstate. And of course, then I would return full contrast. Remember that we're always post-selecting on what we observe. So I return full contrast for those curves. And it wouldn't matter whether I was select up or down, right? And we'll see in a second that we can do some nice two-qubit work with this. All right. I want to come back to your question about the coherence length. in this experiment, we have our wave packet. It's traveling that way. Okay, a little Gaussian wave packet. And as it goes through this piece, of course, it gets split into identical copies, taking the two paths. So we have a coherent superposition of our wave packet spread over those two paths. And if I have my magnetic field here, then over that wave packet, in this path, I'll still have my my nice coherence. But over here, I'll have one wave packet for spin up and one wave packet for spin down, because the velocity during this time was different. Now, we just said, oh, I could make the field big and I would recover the contrast. And we can do that, and it works. But eventually, it no longer works. Because if I look as I increase the magnetic field, and now it gets awkward to draw it here, but effectively what happens is if I increase the magnetic field, I can get to the point where these wave packets no longer overlap with each other. And then, as I go through this interferometer, there would not be interference between those two events. And so what would happen is I would lose all the contrast. And so if I take and think about the wave packet, right, the wave packet is telling us about the spread of information over the neutron interferometer and our ability to recombine it. And we need to keep track of that. And so if I, turns out to be an easy experiment to do, that if I go and I spread them out far enough, then I'll see that instead of this element of the wave function interfering with this one and preferentially going to one of these, there's nothing for it to interfere with, and so it randomly is detected at either one of those detectors. Yeah? All right. But this is what we were going to talk about, so we'll keep here. Okay, so now then we say, we can see some nice features. We can say that one of the ways we lose contrast is because there's some other underlying distribution in our experiment which is going to introduce a random phase. And if I looked at this dynamic on our Bloch sphere, then of course what I would have to do in this case is draw two curves in the XY plane that had different lengths depending upon the strength of the magnetic field that we're looking at. And so the piece I want to keep with you is to say, oh yes, we're going to have a distribution and we're averaging over that distribution, and that's leading to a noise. So I will say that I have some output is equal to the integral of some probability, and I'll put the frequency of noise here. like so, and that we're going to integrate over this noise parameter. Now let's look at what this means in either one of these settings. If I was wanting to use this as a sensor, so I wanted to measure the frequency that the state is rotating in the XY plane. In the idealized case, and let's just imagine that we can measure sigma X. And I'll make it a little bit easier because I want to be in, I'm going to refer to this experiment. But of course, they're the same in either one. So if I wanted to measure sigma X, then I would see an oscillatory function as a function of time, and that this period is going to tell me omega naught, and there's some reason I want to know this, right? This is the desired quantity. And if I took my expectation value as a function of time, and I took a Fourier transform of that, then I would get the delta, I would get two delta functions. Right, the Fourier transform of cosine is two delta functions. Now over here, we have this noise term. And so instead of seeing this, what I'm going to see is a decay of that. It'll still have the right frequency. Because I'm going to define my noise term as always being peaked at zero. And you know, if there's there's no reason to define your noise as something else. So you can always take whatever offset there is and put it back into your system Hamiltonian. Here, you're going to decay. And the decay need not be exponential. But of course, the model that Bloch gave us is for an exponential decay. And we can certainly write down Bloch's equation for Gaussian decay too, but I won't bother to do it. And you guys know the Wiener-Kitchen theorem? Convolution theorem? If you don't, someday you should learn it. So if I take the Fourier transform of two functions that are multiplied together, so here I have f of t times g of t. I want to take the Fourier transform of that. If that's equal to the Fourier transform of f of t convolved with the Fourier transform of g of t. And it comes up a lot. It's a useful thing to keep. And so then we say, oh, well, I've got this piece where I know the Fourier transform of this, right? It's still that. So So I still get this thing, but I get it convolved with the Fourier transform of an exponential, which is a Lorentzian. So I get it convolved with a Lorentzian. There's a factor of pi there. Not that you care about it or that I care about it. And the width of this is given to as 1 over pi times t2. And so if I convolve those two together, then the resultant is to broaden those. They're still located. You wouldn't believe it, but they're still located at the right at the same place. But now my ability to learn that frequency is reduced because I have fewer cycles to sample over. Yeah. So we've got this reduction in information, or this loss of contrast. But it comes from this sort of boring thing that says, I have this distribution of Hamiltonians. And the distribution of Hamiltonians up here said, oh, I got a distribution because every time I interact with the system's a little bit different. Okay? We'll see that in the spins and superconducting case. Or down here, I have a distribution because the particles I'm sending through my interferometer are different depending upon which one I've sent through. So there's some probability distribution that's giving me this difference. And so what Erwin Hahn said that if the underlying distribution is static, then we can remove its influence. And he had a very simple example of it. So we take our system, create an equal superposition, allow it to evolve, and see that it's going to evolve at a series over a series of different angles. And by static distribution, what Erwin is saying is that if I look at this curve, it's always going to be evolving with the same rate. Okay? And then he said, flip the thing over. So I'm going to take the XY plane, I'm just going to flop it over. So you know, this one's going to go here, that one there. And so it's easiest if I say, if I just draw the XY plane. So before, here's X, here's Y. We had this one, this one, this one, after we have this one, and this one, right? They're only going to go like so, just flipping the whole thing over. And then, if we allow them to evolve backwards in time, for a time equal to this time, then they would all come back together in the apparent dephasing that was introduced by this would be suppressed. So that we see here an echo. And the nice thing is that the echo contains no information about the distribution of the noise, right? If I look at the system here, the state contains information about the noise, and that's what we've seen through this. But the echo, right at that instance where you have an echo, and of course, that's what we like to do. We like to say that we can have a system, we can control it. And for those elements that we're not interested in, we can arrange some complicated experiment, perhaps, to suppress the system, to keep the system from learning about those variations. Okay? Of course, the trick is you want to do this simultaneously while keeping the system learning about what you want it to learn, you know, which might be the state of a neighboring qubit if you were doing a computation, right? So we'll have to be a little bit more complicated than that. But this is the idea. Now, of course, This is a very black and white picture of what goes on. Because, you know, on the one hand, we say, oh, up on the top of the board, there's no noise, life is great. And then at the bottom of it, we say, oh, yeah, we have noise, but the noise is going to behave nicely with us. It's either going to be there or it's not going to be there, and it's never going to change. And, of course, that's not the property of noise. Noise fluctuates. And we have this funny picture here that says, oh, if I'm making a measurement on one element of the ensemble that I'm averaging over, I have a random variable of the noise, but it's always the same. But when I go and I make the next measurement, the noise is another different random variable. And so there's a time fluctuation that enters into this that says, hey, what happens if the noise changes over time? And it turns out that if the noise fluctuates on a time scale that's slow compared to our ability to rotate the system, we can find a way of suppressing it. And so if you went back to the block equations, we had this frequency omega 1, which was our ability to rotate the system, right? That was our parameter. And so if the fluctuations of the noise are small compared to that frequency, then you're golden. You can find a way of suppressing it. If it's fast compared to the frequency, then the fluctuations are going to be averaged out before we can do anything. Now, of course, if it's really, really fast, it doesn't show up at all. And if we had a longer course, I'd make you do a homework problem on that too. Okay. Now, I want to just say one more thing before I let you go for looking at this paper today. So today in the tutorial, you're going to use spin as another qubit. So we have our neutron interferometer. And what we're going to do is to put a device here called a supermirror, doesn't matter, which gives you only one spin state out. So now as you prepare your system, you're in an eigenstate of both the path and the spin. This interaction is still not going to depend upon spin, right? So this interaction is still only going to act on the path degree of freedom. But I can include something called a spin flipper. That will invert the state from being up to down. And if you look right here, then you will see that you have an entangled state. And to connect to things that you saw in the previous class, you would say, oh, well, this is a Hadamard. Here's my state preparation. There's my Hadamard. This is the controlled knot. And you know, the nice thing about interferometry, it's easy to see it's controlled knot. We put the action in only one path, right? So absolutely controlled on that path. And so now I have my spin degree of freedom. The phase flag still acts independently of spin. And now let's think about what would happen here if I put this spin detector, spin filter, and then I put my detector. If I put the spin filter so that it would spin up, if I only path spin up, then I better lose all the contrast because I've selected only those neutrons that went through the lower path. And likewise, if I selected spin down, of course, I should lose all contrast. And what I'd really like to do is I'd like to set that spin filter to sigma x so that only those spins which are in a coherent superposition go through. Yeah? Okay, that's all the physics you need to know for this afternoon. Thanks. Any questions?
Two neutron
experiments,
like the
Hollow
Mendel, but like the anti.
We haven't. So there's people have tried to do things to say demonstrate the neutron-neutron interaction. The probability that two neutrons are in the interferometers at the same time is infinitesimally small, and that they're in the same. That their wave packets would overlap is even smaller. So the answer is that if you look at the theory of that, you shouldn't be able to see it. Now, there is a paper that claims that if you send a neutron through an interferometer, and then a short time later you send another one in, the action of the interferometer for the second one is correlated with the first one. But the result is, if you look carefully, they got their statistics wrong.
So there really is like a long time between the neutrons.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're the counting statistics, so the counting rate is about a neutron a second, and the neutrons take about 10 microseconds to go through. Yeah. Yes? That's a good question. So if you take the Bloch sphere, let's go back down here. You have to remember that the wave function is describing what information you can learn about a system, right? The wave function isn't an element of reality. When we're in an eigenstate of the wave function, of course, the eigenstate is time independent, doesn't evolve, it's a stationary quantity. And if our measurement is along the same axis as the quantizing Hamiltonian, so if I'm preparing a state along Z, and I'm measuring a state along Z, and I prepare an eigenstate, then I could projectively measure that and I would learn it. And of course, as I learned it, it would collapse into that state, and if I made another measurement, it would be the same, right? Good. And if I started at the identity, so the identity matrix, the wave function equal to the identity, or a density matrix given by the identity, says you have no information, right? That's what the identity wave function means. And if I take the identity wave function and I make a measurement, then randomly I'll find either that I'm in the zero state or the one state. And then if I made, and then having made a measurement, you know, the trick of strong measurements says that you must update your description of the wave function conditioned on your measurement. So I make a measurement, and I find perhaps that I'm in, that I measured zero, and now I know that the wave function is in that state, and if I make another measurement, etc. Now, we rotate the system so that we're in a coherent superposition of zero and one. And now then, we're saying that the information we could learn of the system is that the state spans those two outcomes, but there's a phase. Here you have to be really careful. You know, you end up in these stories of saying, oh, am I in both paths? No, you're not in both paths. Am I randomly in a path? No, you're not randomly in a path. You're in something else, which we have to call a coherent superposition of both paths, and there's no comfortable model in our classical world that's going to correctly connect that. But what it does say is it says that with this coherence, that if I made a measurement of zero or a measurement about one, half the time I'd find one, half the time the other, and it wouldn't tell me anything about the coherence, because of course if I lost and went to the identity state, I'd see the same thing. But if I made a measurement about X, then as the system evolves, periodically I would find that I would have an eigenstate of that. Or if I made a measurement about Y, periodically I would find. And again, this structure is going to be revealed in the expectation value. You know, if I make one measurement along X, well, I don't learn anything. I mean, I learn one thing. If I get the plus eigenstate, I know that it wasn't in the minus eigenstate, right? but I learned nothing else, yeah? But if I repeat the measurement, I can start, I can learn more. And so this piece says two things. You know, it says that you're spanning both bases and you're sampling them equally. But more importantly, it says that there's a phase which is going to describe how the two pieces of information come together. And it's this phase which is the key feature of the superposition. And of course, in this particular experiment, that phase is time dependent. And so it gives us a very systematic way of probing it. And what decoherence means is that we've lost that phase. So we've gone from being at the equator to at the center of the sphere.
So the question was about contrast, though.
Yeah, okay. So you wanted me to say the depth of those curves. My answer took 20 times as long. Come on.
No,
yeah, absolutely. So the contrast as an observed quantity is this fringe in the depth of the modulation.
And that's related to the decoherence.
Yeah, as we see here, right? Yeah. That for each of the spin states, we have full contrast, but if we average over the two, the contrast is reduced. Thanks.